there is a problem within Punjabi culture or something, they use as a way of justice. Let's say you are of a tribe, you have wronged me somehow, then to correct that wrong, I am allowed for someone from my tribe gang one of your daughters, and that would, you know, resolve that problem.
Momus Najmi is a writer, podcaster, and self-proclaimed free thinker
whose nomadic journey from Kuwait to Karachi to Essex shaped his fearless voice.
What's your theory on why they have groomed and raped, they've handed around like sweeties, these white girls? Why are they doing this?
It is a fundamental thing to do with Islam. The way that they see it, that they are conquering these countries by their people, and these are the boundaries of their conquest. The way that they can squash the spirit of the people is to degrade their own people that much.
So what does it say about the British that we've let this happen?
The British people are so far removed that they cannot understand those sort of ideology anymore, because they're so far behind in their time that they could have understood this.
Is there some weird thing in the culture that they just like really, really young girls?
It is a cultural thing, so they don't see that as a wrong. But to explain that, if we just say they're evil and just dismiss all of it, we don't really get to the bottom of why it's happening, why, and also why it's important for us to stop immigration coming from these countries.
As a Pakistani, there is prestige to being able to say, I'm with a white girl.
They don't see them as prestigious or something. They only see them as things for conquest, as horrible as it is to say. They do really have racial hatred, like especially Pakistanis. Things that they do have deep-rooted racial hatred against the white British people.
Do you think there's something about the culture of the Punjabis to what has been happening in places like Mobile?
Those sort of ideologies come into. And as the left has progressively, with their Marxist ideologies, taken over most of the British culture, they're going to use that as well to their advantage. And that's what they're doing to their advantage. And the propensity of them marrying their cousins, first cousins, so much, 60-70%, you know, that's going to result in eventually
reducing IQ slightly, yes. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic on tour. I have a very special guest for you today, and that is Momus. And Momus is a commentator on such issues, a social commentator, I suppose, particularly on such issues as Islam. And today we are going to talk about aspects of Islam in the UK. So, Momus, hello.
Hello. Thank
you. Can you tell us a bit about you first? So you're originally from Pakistan?
Well, I was born in Kuwait. So I'm originally, I guess, from there, from the Gulf. My parents are from Pakistan. And I lived in Pakistan for 9 years after my teens. And then I came to England in 2010.
But you were saying earlier that what you just couldn't, you didn't like.
I couldn't assimilate with Pakistan, I would say. Kuwait was a bit different. Even though it's a Gulf state, it's not as restricted as Saudi Arabia. It's more like Dubai, you would say. So there's a bit more lax culture, a bit more lax when it comes to Islam itself. When I went to Pakistan, people were a bit too different for me to assimilate into.
And you were saying that you've been told by your father or your parents about the pre-General Huck, is that his name?
Ziaul Haq, yeah.
Yeah, the pre-him Pakistan, where it wasn't a fundamentalist state.
Yeah, it was a bit different. Like, from their youth, what they tell me, probably, like, when they left was during that time anyways, after General Zia, but the Pakistan was changing at that time. It didn't have transformed yet. So Pakistan before what they described was a bit different than what I found. The Pakistan that I found was, you know, was a lot more radical, more Islamized. Things like the things like arts and literature were not that much of a focus of the people, and I found that very hard to assimilate into, because I couldn't connect them as my people.
Right. So when you say my people, I mean Pakistan is quite ethnically diverse, I suppose you could say. There's not only there are a number of different states within, but whatever you call them, within Pakistan,
provinces.
So the Punjab and places, I think, that thing I can't pronounce.
Balochistan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa.
Yeah, I can pronounce Balochistan, but Sindh, yes, but the Khyber.
Khyber Pakhtunkhwa.
That's the one, yeah. So a number of different areas, a number of different languages, a number of ethnic groups. Mm-hmm. So what would you say characterizes the key differences between these ethnic groups?
Well, I think so. But I'm not that old, so I wouldn't know what was actually Pakistan living over there. You can only understand by stories of what people tell them, tell other people, you know. But I think so people were able to express their regional sort of culture more. What happened, I think, so after General Ziaul-Haq is more of an Islamization of Pakistan, where everyone became more radically Muslim, or be like they were probably pulled by radical Islam a bit more. So all over Pakistan, you know, you got this people which didn't favor, you know, literature or you know, arts or any endeavors which, you know, which were.
And what kind of radical Islam was General Al-Haq? What, Wahhabi or Muslim Brotherhood type thing?
I would say like he was Sunni. So I'm not sure if it was Wahhabi or not. But I think so he was generally Sunni, because he's the one who fought against Palestinians as well for Jordan. And he fought against because they were Shias. So he was Sunni. But he was a Sunni radical. And it's not as if, it doesn't even matter how much of a radical he himself was. It's what he unleashed. Because before him, Pakistan had the Pakistani Penal Code, which was based upon English common law. And what he did was he put Sharia law into the Pakistani Penal Code. And obviously Sharia law will eventually become, will eventually supersede English common law. And that's the radicalization of not just of the people, even if the people didn't agree, by law, it came in.
And I understand that the Balochis, they want to kind of break away.
Balochis always want, like Balochistan has always been separate. You know, all of the provinces have been like sort of separate anyways, because they're so ethnically separate and their languages are so separate. They have wanted to separate from Pakistan for a very long time. And there are things that the Pakistani government, under the heavy rule of probably, I would say, like the Punjabi involvement, they have done a lot of harm and a lot of, you know, atrocities against the Balochis. And they wanted to separate. And there has been rumors before as well that they were colluding with Indian intelligence or something of that sort for separation. I don't know how much of that was true or not, but they always wanted to separate. And right now as well, those troubles are becoming even more violent.
So which is the ethnic group like that tends to dominate in Pakistan? The Punjabis?
Punjabis, yeah, because they're the most. And they hold most of the agricultural, equity within Pakistan. They hold the most political sway within Pakistan. They have the most number of seats in parliament. And they tend to... You know,
they didn't used to back in the old days. No, the largest by population area of Pakistan was East Pakistan.
This is why they broke up, because the Punjabis couldn't have their way, so
they could just dominate it.
Yeah,
and so then of course they sent in, and this gets into what we're going to talk about in relation to the UK. They literally the Punjabi imams issued, as I understand it, fatwas. Mm. Saying that it was okay to go into East Pakistan, what's now Bangladesh, and commit war crimes, and in particular the raping of women. And in the war was in 71, I think I'm right in saying.
Yeah.
And in 1972, there was something like, I think it was 250,000 women that were raped.
Yeah.
And there was 50,000 war babies. Mm. There was all these women with STDs.
Yeah.
There was about 30,000 abortions,
mm-hmm.
All in the 1 year.
Yeah.
So what they did was just, and this was to fellow, it was to Hindus as well, because there was a Hindu minority there.
Yeah.
But this was to fellow Muslims, and they said they weren't real Muslims and it was okay.
Yeah. I mean, it was state-sanctioned rape. And this is the thing as well, it wasn't just the imams doing it, they used the imams to do it. It was state-sanctioned rape, because they justified it. They always find ways to justify it. I think so. There's a problem within the Punjabi culture or something, that they use rape as a way of justice, delivering justice. There are a few cases within Punjab where they have tribal issues. So if, let's say, you are of a tribe, you have wronged me somehow, then to correct that wrong, I am allowed for someone from my tribe to rape one of your daughters, gang rape one of your daughters, and that would, you know, resolve that problem. That woman had nothing to do with it. Those men have nothing to do with it. This is their way of resolving issues. So there has to be some other ethnically historic.
Is that sanctified by the Quran or the Hadith or anything like that?
No. This is a problem as well. Like, this is actually not Islamic. I think this predates Islam, because you can find excuses within Islam, but say like sex slaves,
or
like
you can take any woman that your right arm can hold.
Exactly. You know, in times of war and stuff. But this is not in times of war. This is like people trying to resolve their disputes, their tribal disputes. So they can use Islam, but this means that it predates Islam, or what the practices were of these people, and why they're more susceptible to taking Islam anyways so much on board, because Islam allows for certain things that, which are their sexual deviant proclivities, and they just take that on board. That's why they're more susceptible.
Well, the religion in that area before Islam was Hinduism.
Yeah.
So the question is do they engage in such behaviors in any form of Hinduism? I don't know, but I know they do the horrible punishments of women.
Yeah.
In Hinduism. That's interesting. Hmm. But anyway, in Bangladesh, it was a time of war.
Yeah.
And so I suppose you could argue that's how they could theologically justify what they did.
Yeah.
And then the tribunal, whatever you call the Peace and Justice Commission into this took a very long time for all of the information to come out on just how Bangladesh was brutalized.
Yeah. It was because my grandfather from my mum's side, her father, he fought in that war as well, and he was, as far as I know, like, he was left behind enemy lines and he had to come back somehow, but he was fighting somewhere in India and Bangladesh something. There were a lot of rumors as well, like, people knew that this has happened, people who didn't agree with it, especially people who fought for Pakistan, who were from other areas than Punjab, you know, because they were not part of this. They weren't told to do these sort of things, and they were against these things theologically as well as, you know, as a human being. They didn't agree with such things because apart from, like, everyone in Pakistan already had a feeling that Punjab is taking advantage and trying to take advantage of the political system within Pakistan. They're trying to get more seats. That's why they won't accept the Bangladeshis, Bengalis, as their prime minister, you know, because he actually won. So there was already discontent between that. And I think so after that, the discontent even grew more between the Urdu-speaking people and Punjabis. And Punjabis against Balochis, them against Pathans. And, you know, they started separating even then. So there were huge differences, huge disagreements. So it's not all Pakistanis had committed those crimes, and they would agree with those crimes as well, to do those crimes. But it doesn't matter, because the majority of people the majority of Pakistanis who are in Britain, 90% of them are ethnically Punjabis. So that's
now,
what
I assumed, and I think I did a video on this, that the reason why all of the men, or the vast majority of the men that were involved in these Pakistani grooming gangs, were Punjabi was just historical. It was that we, the British, kind of industrialized or at least brought in infrastructure into the Punjab. Mm. We knew that the people in the Punjab could speak English. Mm. And so, which was not the case in Balochistan. It was rural. We didn't have much to do with it. People couldn't speak English. Mm. And so we literally went there advertising for labor. And also in Kashmir. Mm. And so it's those people that have come over. Mm. And therefore it's those people that have engaged in grooming behavior. We can talk whatever gang rape. We can talk about why one would do that. From an evolutionary perspective, I've got ideas on it. Mm. But you had a lot of it in the Congo War. Mm. It's not unique to Islam. Mm. But do you think there's something about the culture of the Punjabis which is relevant to what has been happening in places like Rotherham?
I'm actually sometimes I'm very trying to be careful about commenting on this because I know I have a prejudice against Punjabis, right? Growing up as an Urdu speaking people, we had a different view of the Punjabis. We always saw them as uncultured and uncouth people compared to how we were as Urdu speaking people. And there is an undertone over there of, like, you know, there is an ethnic war sort of between these two people, at least disagreements between these two people.
In what sense do the Urdu speakers regard the Punjabis as uncultured?
The way that they behave.
How do they behave?
You know, talking very loudly, not being polite, not giving way to people, you know, their sense of humor. Punjabis are more likely to enjoy slapstick humor compared to Urdu-speaking people who prefer more intellectual humor. You know, all sort of things, like, you know, Urdu-speaking people are most likely, they like tongue twisters, they like, you know, innuendos, they like sarcasm. Punjabis do not have that in their, you know, culture that much. So they seem a bit uncultured to an Urdu-speaking people and how they behave and how, and not just that, even within parliament, even within politics, you can see the difference between a Punjabi politician of how they act, how brazen they are in their lies and their deceit compared to maybe an Urdu speaking people or even a Sindhi or even like other sort of, you know, Pathans specifically, like, you know, they're known in Pakistan to be more honest people, the Pathans. And they don't engage in deceit that much. They are more in army and, like, you know, they're represented over there a lot. So there are differences, I would say. And I think so. Maybe they were just inbuilt prejudices because of how they treated the Urdu-speaking people. Urdu-speaking people are the very small minority within Pakistan. And Urdu language is their native language. All the other parts of the Pakistan, their native language is not. Their mother tongue is not Urdu. Urdu is a second language for them. So they have their regional languages and Urdu is a second language.
Is Urdu not a kind of lingua franca throughout Pakistan, or is that English?
It's sort of English, yeah. So English and Urdu. So law is written in both Urdu and English because of that reason as well. There are parts of Pakistan that actually don't know Urdu. You know, I've traveled to places in the north of Pakistan. They can't speak Urdu, so I have to speak in English with them because they're speaking their regional language, which I don't understand. So it's interesting dynamics over there, but I think so. There is a perception of the Punjabis being uncultured.
Right, and so how does this then fit into what we're seeing in these northern towns these towns where there's large numbers of Punjabis?
So in the 1960s, when Harold Wilson thought it would be a good idea to get these people in and replace them as labourers in the north of England, these were mainly people around Mirpur, you know, those villages around Mirpur and stuff outside on the outskirts of Kashmir. And the reason was because there was a dam that was built and thousands of people were misplaced. So these people were free and sort of, like, you know, could be used as laborers. He got 50,000-60,000 of those people eventually in and settled them into England. These people were laborers, yeah, but I don't think so they would have even assimilated into a metropolitan city within Pakistan, even at that time. So these weren't like your educated and those sort of people. So these people did come over here. Other Pakistani people came over here as well. And they, because they were less in numbers, there was where they weren't in a place, you know, where they could have their parallel societies, they didn't assimilate over there. But those when they weren't in those societies, they tried to assimilate into, you know, more metropolitan cities within England. These people, what has happened over time, I think, so it's not that those people are the fault because they didn't engage in rape gangs or anything at that time. It's because of them, because they always maintain their parallel societies. To do that, they have to marry people from Pakistan. So they keep on getting those people in. So their sons will marry like their cousins or whatever from Pakistan, and they will keep on fettering people in. So over time, as Pakistan has changed, the people that this parallel community has been bringing in have been more and more radical.
Right.
Over time. So that's why the newer people that we are seeing that have come because of these people are just naturally more radical because of the changes that have happened in Pakistan.
Do these kind of fundamentalist backward people within Pakistan have more children than educated Pakistanis?
Yeah, they would. Their standard of living is low. They're living in villages, whatever. And mostly they're using children as labor, as child labor. So they need to have more children. So, you know, within educated class within Karachi, Lahore, Islamabad, you know, Quetta, people will have less children. 3 at most, 4 at most, not more than that.
Right. So, but they're having 6 or 7 kids in these.
Because they're using them as child labor.
Right, and they're not very intelligent, perhaps, and they're very fundamentalist.
Yeah, even if they are intelligent, their intelligence is not, you know, explored. It's not utilized. It's not, you know, it's beaten out of them. Even if there was anything over there, you know, but and the propensity of them marrying their cousins, first cousins, so much, 60-70%, you know, that's going to result in eventually.
Reducing IQ slightly, yes. So, right. So, and so they are continuously imported. Is what you're saying,
yeah.
And this has made a founded, Kashmiri, Punjabi, whatever community, more and more extreme over time.
Yeah,
and perhaps more ethnocentric over time.
Yeah,
because you marry your cousin, then you're creating a genetic cluster.
Mm. And over time. If you keep on doing that and you are growing in strength and you're growing in numbers, so you see less and less point of wanting to assimilate. Why would you want to assimilate? Why not assimilate Britain into you? You know, that's those sort of ideologies come into. And as the left has progressively, with their Marxist ideologies, taken over most of the British culture or, you know, subverting the British culture, they're going to use that as well to their advantage. And that's what they're doing to their advantage. And then came the time of mass immigration, which actually blew up everything. Because even before that time, this could have been managed easily. But when mass migration came in, people even more radical came in who were not related to these people, even these people at all. So they had no way of controlling them. And those are the radical Muslims who eventually, you know, took over. Those were the radical Muslims who took over their communities. They have taken over their communities. And you know, they are leaving them, you know, they basically have no choice, because if these radical Muslims take over their mosque and stuff and the imams are telling you that, then who are you as a moderate Muslim who don't know their religion properly to challenge them? And that's what's, I think, that's the dynamics that are playing out.
Yeah, okay. And so, but why then, what's your theory on why they have groomed and raped, handed around like sweeties, these white girls? Why are they doing this?
There's a part of, I mean, I've seen that, like, because in Finland this has happened as well, and Syrians who are doing that. And in other countries, Sweden, it's happening as well. And there are other thing doing that. And that tells me something. It is a fundamental thing to do with Islam. The ideology of them growing their ummah, their, you know, Islamic ummah, that they want the hope to grow into the West. The way that they see it, that they're conquering these countries by their people. And these are the bounties of their, you know, their conquest. The way that they can squash the spirit of the people is to degrade their own people that much, you know.
I suppose particularly degrade their own women, to be able to say to these men,
yeah,
you're so weak
that you can't even defend.
You can't even, you, I can't, and also won't.
Yeah.
And I think that's an interesting point that we don't like to talk about. People like to sort of simplify this and say, oh, it's just these evil Pakistani men, and they are grooming and then raping these white girls, and they are exploiting them and whatever. But you've got to ask yourself, well, what does it say about Britain as a society? That it seems to me you're obviously going to, if you come into a country as a foreigner, as a conspicuous foreigner of a different race, and you're poorer than other people, then you're going to want to you're going to feel resentful.
Mm.
You're going to feel angry.
Yeah.
And this tends to make people excluded.
Mm.
This tends to make people more religious.
Mm.
And you will find in the religion, as you will in the Old Testament, justifications for quite unpleasant behavior,
yeah.
killing the enemy, and in the case of Islam, taking the women as sex slaves. And so we shouldn't really be surprised that they would react like that. And so what does it say about the British that we've let this happen?
I think so. They're so far removed from that ideology. So the British people are so far removed that they cannot understand those sort of ideology anymore, because they're so far behind in their time that they could have understood this. But what we have done over here is people who are so far removed from that sort of thinking being introduced with people who are acting like they would in the past. And this is why they can't comprehend each other. They are trying to see the best of these people, but there isn't. And what usually happens as well, I think so, is exceptions that become dangerous in a way. Like, let's say if I'm an exception to the rule, that I am not partaking in that behavior or do not have that mentality, and people only meet people like me, then they would say, oh, Pakistanis are okay, they're fine. People of Pakistani ethnicity are fine. And in that guise would come in people who are actually not fine, the majority of those people who are not fine. Because if the majority of the Pakistanis were fine, then you wouldn't find them having such sexual crimes in their own country as well, against their own people as well. So
it's not even just a Muslim thing. If you think it is a weapon of war. Mm-hmm. It's what you do to undermine the enemy.
And that's what Vikings did, and
it's what the Russians did. Yeah. I mean, I think I've read estimations that about one third of German women under the age of 30 were raped when Germany was occupied by Russia.
Yeah, that's what they did to Poland as well. And my wife is Polish, like, you know. They have all these stories about Russians. They actually have these stories that when the Nazis came over Poland, they were less cruel to certain parts of Polish people than the Russians were.
I've heard this, that the people much preferred the Nazi occupation to the Russian occupation.
Yeah.
And the Nazis came as invaders of their country. Yeah.
Now, before we continue, I'd like to talk about something rather exciting. I know that you Generation Z people, you want to have read all of the based books, you want to have imbibed all of the most radical and important scientific knowledge, but you don't particularly like reading very much. So what if there was an app that would take those books, summarize them for you, and then read them back to you in less than 25 minutes? Well, fortunately, such an app exists, and that app is called Legion.com. They have, for example, my book, The Past is a Future Country, The Coming Conservative Demographic Revolution, by myself and my friend Ollie Rayner Hills, in which we look at the way that there is clearly going to be a shift based on breeding patterns among the more intelligent back towards us being right-wing, and the return, therefore, of a kind of genetically right-wing society, a kind of neo-Byzantium. And here it is, The Past of the Future Country. And so you don't even have to read the book if you don't want to. This can inject it straight from the phone into your brain box. And if you sign up today with the code TJH, then, of course, you can get a 10% discount. So Legion.com, sign up now. All the base knowledge from your phone, direct to your brain.
Yeah. I've heard a story from a friend of mine in Poland that his grandmother had, what was it she said, that she had nothing bad really to say about the Nazis in the occupation of Poland, but the Russians absolutely despised.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the Nazis were bad to most of the Poland when they put them in concentration camps and stuff, but they didn't treat all of them in the same way. The thing was, like, when Russians were coming over, they wanted to do these things, these bad things and stuff. And there were stories that they were going in people's home trying to get food because they didn't have any food. So they were very depraved of all things. But you're right to say, like, all such societies have used, even Germans in the past when they were Germanic tribes and stuff, they have used rape as a way, as a form of war. All these older sort of civilizations have used that. And Islam is just stuck in that, you know, mentality for 1400 years. and they have an
impact. And also, I suppose, though, it is true that you do tend to get, and perhaps there is a level on which, depending on their age and which issues of consent and whatever, but putting that aside, you do tend to get a collaboration horizontale, i.e. the idea that women sexually select for power and status and that sort of thing. And if you're able to invade, then what that is signalling to the woman is that you're the people with the future status.
Yeah.
And therefore, you're the ones to be with. There were many cases of this in relationships between German soldiers and French women in the war, Norwegian, various others, Finnish, even on the Channel Islands, when the Germans occupied the Channel Islands, there were relationships between the local women and these German soldiers. That women like status, and there's a degree to which...
I guess you hold the resources and you hold, so you promise security more than the...
You promise security, but because you've managed to successfully invade, you're telling them that you have the power, you're the way forward. And I wonder if there's something about that with Pakistanis in these northern towns. First of all, they tend to be businessmen, which a lot of British people in these kind of poorer towns are just unemployed. And secondly, they tend to be quite flash with their cash, nice cars, and it's materialistic. Yeah. And that's going to impress, I'm afraid, a certain kind of...
I mean, I would say like that would be the reason or why we see that they are able to exploit those British girls that much. But if they were women, that would be a different case. These aren't women. These are children. So the reason why they're going after the children is because they're vulnerable and they are easy to impress upon, you know, because they are from broken homes. They are misguided, you know, so they give them the things that they don't have access to. They can't buy the cigarettes. They can't buy the drugs. They can't buy all those things. So if that was the case that they're showing their strength, that would be upon the woman and not children. So
yes, all right, true. But I suppose there is a level on which even children are impressed by such things. I'm saying they don't have consent. They don't can't consent. Fine.
Yeah.
But there is a degree to which it, and they know this perhaps, as you say, it's going to impress them. And so then you end up with why is it? Do you think it's just that they are manipulative and psychopathic and thus want to go for little girls? I mean, as young as 12 or 11. Or is there some weird thing in the culture that they just like really, really young girls?
I think so. See, because most of the people say, oh, they're just psychotic and they're just evil people and that's why, like, they're just pedophiles. I don't think so they are pedophiles, that's why they're doing it. I think so it is a cultural thing because it's acceptable in their culture to marry girls when they're so young, just after puberty when they're so young. So they don't see that as a wrong and has been embedded in their culture and you know, their mums would have married their fathers when they were that young, you know, so they don't see that as an issue. When they go after like really young girls, which are pre-puberty, like 9 years old, 8 years old, 7 years old, that shows proper sexual deviance, that there is something wrong mentally with them as well. I think so it's a combination of that, and also it's a combination of they are easy targets. You know, it's much harder to do that to a fully grown woman as compared to 11 or 12-year-old girls or 13-year-old girls. So it's a complex of issues. If we just say that, okay, they're evil, eventually their actions are evil. You know, eventually I would like them to see them hanged for what they're doing. But how to explain that if we just say they're evil and just dismiss all of it, we don't really get to the bottom of why it's happening, why it's important for us to stop the immigration coming from these countries, why it is important.
Yeah, because they would hang in Pakistan for behavior like this.
Yeah.
Which is something we can learn perhaps from Pakistan. But they engage in this exploitative behavior, they manipulate them. Is there a level on which I mean, you're married to a white girl.
Yeah.
Is there a level on which, as a Pakistani or whatever in the UK, among other Pakistanis, there is prestige to being able to say, I'm with a white girl?
It wouldn't be when it comes to working class girls, to be honest, because, you know, they don't see them as prestigious, as far as I can see that, you know, they don't see them as prestigious or something. They only see them as things for conquest, as horrible as it is to say. They don't see marrying a white working class British girl as anything prestigious, because she doesn't have good family or something. The things that they value, she doesn't have.
So when
their parents wouldn't want them to marry white girls.
So when they talk about, I presume that I've read books like what's her name, Mirza Ali. She's a writer, and she did this sort of autobiographical novel about what it's like to be an Indian girl in England in the 50s.
Yeah,
and she in the book that the attitude of this is Hindus, I think, but towards white girls, it wouldn't work. Working class white girls is that they're just dirty.
Oh yeah,
it's dirty. They have no morals. They do anything.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I mean there was such a when I was in Pakistan, there was such a weird thing that people had, like in some pockets I heard somewhere that, oh, you know, the reason why these white girls can go around in skirts in these cold weather is because they put pig oil on their legs. They make up such weird stories, you know. They do really have racial hatred, like especially Pakistanis. Things that they do have deep-rooted racial hatred against the white British people, specifically white British people, not other white Europeans, specifically white British people. Because I think so they are still in that mindset that their rule of India, as the Muslims' rule of India, was disrupted because of the British, because they came over there and they disrupted it. So they see that as the British are the reason why they lost India, you know, and they only have Pakistan now. So if it wasn't for them, they would have, remained conquerors over there. So I think so.
Well, to be fair, if they'd behaved themselves during the Sepoy Rebellion, rather than massacring loads of innocent English women.
But that's their way, you know, that's how they are. You know, they destroyed India by conquering it. This is why I don't even call Pakistan. Pakistan is not a legitimate state. It shouldn't exist.
Because that was when the guy that was based in New Delhi, what's the Sultan? What's the word I want? But anyway, the king.
Mm.
That was when he lost. That was when the British took direct control of various parts of India and left other parts, both Muslim and Hindu.
Mm.
But they took control of that area.
Mm.
Because that, which had been the one that had been run by Muslims, the Golden Triangle around there, because they engaged in a massive rebellion.
Exactly. it's such old history as well, and shows me like why are they keeping those old seeded resentments with them? Why can't they move forward? Why can't they say, okay, what has happened has happened. Let's move forward. How can we have the best expression of ourselves? But they don't. They know they're not capable enough to do those things.
Well, look at Iran now. They've just arrested two British tourists claiming they're spies.
Mm.
Now, the Iranians hate the British. I don't know why you'd go there. For the colonial reasons.
Yeah.
They hate the British.
Yeah.
With a passion you can't believe.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know why you would go there, but it's for the same kind of reasons. Oh, dear. Okay, so there is that, and there is this, I suppose, as well, if you move into a country and you're poor and you're excluded, then you come up with a cope, and the cope is that the British are dirty.
Resentment is a very, very dangerous emotion. It makes different people do different things. I think so that plays a lot, and, you know, they become so resentful, especially as you're saying, like, you know, they're poor people, especially when they're coming as poor people, and they see other people enjoying things and they can't have those things because A, they find out that, okay, they're not capable enough to have those things or whatever. So they find ways to, you know, get them because that's all that matters to them, that materialistic outlook.
But moving back to the question then, if it's a middle-class brown person and a middle-class girl, then with other Indians or other Pakistanis in the UK, is it considered prestigious to have an English girl?
I guess yes. I guess it would be. But also, like, I don't have personal experience of it, so I can't really say that much, but...
Well, you have a white girl.
Yeah, but I don't have, as in, I don't have the personal experience of, because I don't have any brown friends. Oh, I see. Or, yeah.
Because a friend of mine in Olu, who's Indian extraction, this is what he told me. That it's considered, among other fellow Indians, it's considered, it's wow.
Like, a considered a coup.
Yeah,
like,
you got a white girl.
Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I'm just wondering, why would that be?
Maybe it's like, maybe they have insecurities about themselves, physical insecurities, maybe like physical capability-wise, like sexual capability-wise or whatever insecurities they have. So if someone, some of them like pull, you know, a white girl, a white British girl, it might be seen as, okay, this person has game or whatever you might call it. Like, you know,
because he's conquered. Actually... He's in a sense,
yeah,
symbolically conquered.
Yeah.
The native people.
Yeah.
Got one of their girls.
Yeah, which is so perverse, because the only way that you can actually assimilate... Actually, this is a very good point, because the only way that you can assimilate into a different culture is by, you know, eventually, you know, you can't assimilate, but your future generations can, if you mix in with the ethnicity of that host country. But it's very important to note that these Pakistanis or these Indians don't usually have their women assimilate into the British British men. Maybe Indians do, but not that many Pakistanis.
Not that many Indians, really.
Yeah. So they are seeing, when men do go on with these women, they are seeing that as a conquest, because the men are doing it. If they wanted to assimilate, if the intention was to assimilate, then the same would be for the woman. Why are they not marrying their daughters?
Women sexually select for status and all that. And so what you would expect is that it would be the women, it would be women, Indian, whatever women, that would be marrying white men.
Yeah.
Which is, of course, what happened in the Raj.
Mm.
I mean, that's why Anglo-Indians exist.
Yeah.
It was overwhelmingly British soldiers marrying Muslim girls.
Yeah.
And there was, what was that guy's name? Was it Dalrymple or something? That was the guy's name. There was, he was called the White Raja. And he went over there and he married the daughter of the Prime Minister of Hyderabad. Mm. This is in the late 18th century, before race mixing became less acceptable for a while. And then converted to Islam.
Mm.
And used to wear a Muslim clothes, hooker, and Lieutenant Colonel Kirkpatrick. That was his name, Kirkpatrick. So that it tended to happen that way round, and thus we have Anglo-Indians.
Yeah.
But it's almost like a lower status ethnic group has got a woman from a higher status ethnic group.
Yeah.
Respect, babe.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess, how it might be working.
Yeah.
Now that this has come out, I mean, the thing is, a lot of people say, I was at this conference the other day, there was a guy called Douglas Murray, and they say very extreme things about Islam. Another woman there, Ayan Hirsi Ali, have you heard of her?
Yeah.
Are you ready for the future of the West?